Okay, so I will start by saying that my specialization is not quantum matter physics, it's foundations of physics. But in the last few years, I took an interest in interrelation invariant systems. And this one, I started reading about quantum matter physics and learning about tensor network states and this stuff, and even hired a postdoc, Subinder Singh, who has a really good background in tensor networks, to work with me. And I'm going to speak about some problems that appear, I think, very naturally in foundations, and that you can solve using some tools from quantum matter, in particular with tensor network states. And at the same time, I'm going to speak about some properties of infinite translation invariant systems that I haven't seen explored anywhere else. So hopefully, this will be a bit of interest for people in quantum matter, because these things are also present in quantum matter systems. Can I change? Yeah. Okay. Okay, so first of all, I will start with the motivation according to foundations of physics. Suppose that you have some scientist who takes some rockets and then start exploring the universe. And how do you explore the universe? Well, by conducting experiments. Now, I'm not going to speak about what is the nature of these experiments. You can imagine whatever. A possibility would be that they are perhaps probing locally the vacuum of some quantum field theory. Okay? The important thing is that the experiments are giving them some outcomes. And then if you repeat them enough, they can see what are the correlations between the outcomes. So suppose that they do get some correlation between the outcomes of their experiments. And then they also observe that whenever they conduct the experiment, it doesn't really matter where they are, where they have their spaceship. But the only thing that really matters is the relative position between the different spaceships. That is, if you decide to conduct the experiment like over there, right? I mean, they would exactly observe the same statistics. And same over there and over there, etc. So after some time, they would have to conclude that even though they didn't explore the whole space, the infinite space, maybe only the solar system or some the vicinity of the Earth, they would conclude that maybe this property holds everywhere, not only in the regions that they explored. And you could call this property translation invariance. Translation invariance means that no matter wherever they are, they could be in another faraway hot galaxy, if they conduct the experiment and they have the same relative position and orientation, then they would observe the same statistics. Okay, so physically,
they should not go too close to the sun or stars.
This should. Well, I mean, probably that they can, of course, yeah. Okay, so if you want to model physically what these people are doing, you would imagine that they are tapping the sides of an infinite translation invariant system. So each of them has access to one site, and then that's where they get these correlations that do not depend on where and which particular sites they are. Okay, let's for simplicity assume that for the moment, just for the moment, that they are in one dimension. Okay, even because. Well, maybe perhaps because the world where they live is one-dimensional, or perhaps because they decided to do experiments in a line. Okay, so the idea is, this is the main idea of this talk. From this local information, these people can gather. I mean, of course, they are only finitely many, so they can only hope to explore a finite part of this infinite line. They want to try to infer some properties, global properties, about the whole line, about things that they haven't seen yet. Okay, for example, one of these properties could be whether the whole state is entangled. If its site is some quantum system, then these three guys have access to a tripartite quantum system. And then they wonder whether the whole chain is actually entangled under the assumption of translation invariance. So there have been some papers about these kind of things, but I don't like them very much because they focus, not all of them, but most of them focus on bipartite entanglement. And the idea is like you assign some sites to one of the parties and some other sites to other parties, and then you check whether this state is entangled or not. But in this talk, I'm going to consider multipartite entanglement. So ideally, I would imagine that I'm going to assign a site to each of these parties. And then I would say that the total state of the chain is entangled if I cannot express it as a statistical mixture of product of pure states. Or alternatively, you can also understand entangled states as a state that you cannot generate like this. This is like a super scientist that is sending some classical communication to these other scientists here who are distributed in the line. And this, according to this communication, that each of the scientists then makes a preparation here. So each state, whenever you cannot prepare your state omega like this, you see that omega is entangled. Okay, now, they want to assess whether the whole state, the whole chain is entangled. And it is possible that they measure these two sites, for example, and they conclude that these two sites is entangled. In which case, it would obviously follow that the whole chain is entangled. However, the fact that suppose that they find that the state that they can measure is actually, or probe this is actually separable, that doesn't necessarily imply that the whole state is separable. And I'm going to put something that before we started this study, it was just a theoretical conjecture. Okay? So it could be that these two people measure their state and they find that it is separable. But it is such that there doesn't exist any translation invariant state, which is separable, which has these marginals, which has this two reduced density matrix. That is a possibility. And in that case, they know that even though they are not sharing an entangling resource, they know that the whole state is entangled. Okay, so what does that mean? What it means is that if they could call more parties to occupy all other sites, then at some point these parties will be occupying an entangled state whenever the number of parties is long enough. Okay, and then but the interesting thing is that they get all this information just from local measurements. Okay, you can make the same questions when you don't think about quantum states, when you think about boxes. In this case, we would model each site as some black box that gets an input and gives you an output, right? It's a black box. You can imagine, you can think of the input, for example, at measurement settings. And the outputs could be measurement outcomes, okay? But we're not going to make any assumption about what goes on inside this black box. If that this black box were actually a classical system, then it would be implementing a function. So you would introduce the input, and then this machine would give you some output AX, right? I mean, it would have like some vector of possible outputs. And depending on which input you give, if you give input 1, it will give you the output A1. If you give it input M, it will give you the output AM, and so on. Look, what happens is that in general, you will not have access to this vector of outputs, and you have to model it with some probability distribution. Now we have several boxes, you can do exactly the same. So if you want to reproduce the behavior of all these boxes when people introduce inputs and get outputs with a classical device, then you would need to imagine that in each of these boxes there's a vector of possible outcomes, and all these vectors are distributed according to some probability distribution that you don't really have access to. Okay? And this we call this probability distribution the local hidden variable model. So this is what we want to determine, whether there exists a local hidden variable model where there exists a way to simulate, a classical way to simulate the statistics that these people are observing. And again, the same question arises. It could be that these two people probe these two sites, and then they find that there is a classical device can reproduce the statistics that they're observing. It could be. But it could be that at the same time there doesn't exist any translational invariant classical device that can reproduce the statistics of the whole, can reproduce the statistics that they're observing. And in that case, we conclude that, okay, these two boxes are not Bell local, or they can be reproduced classically, but not the whole chain. So these are the kind of things that are the kind of questions I'm going to be asking in this talk. Now, there's an alternative motivation, which is to study entanglement and non-locality in condensed matter systems. Suppose that you have one-dimensional condensed matter system, and suppose that you probe it with a beam of neutrons. And if you study the scattering of these neutrons, then you can obtain these structure factors. And structure factors, what they allow you to determine is, suppose that you consider the state of one particle and the particle which is r sites away from it. Well, you cannot estimate this with structure factors, but what you do is to estimate like some average of these kind of states through the whole chain. This is what you can estimate using X-ray ring diffraction or neutron diffraction. And the question is the same. You have access only to this information, to the structure factors. And the question is the chain entangled or is the chain non-local? But in principle, this seems like two different problems. They're related because in both cases, you're trying to estimate entanglement and non-locality. But in this case, you have a finite system with no symmetries in principle. And in this other case, you have an infinite system, which is translation invariant. But actually, what happens is that if you restrict only to structure factors that only pertain to particles that are not very separated as compared to the system size, then these two pictures are equivalent. In the sense that if I produce some entanglement weakness over inequality that is based on these structure factors, then if I replace the structure factors by the states, then I will have an entanglement weakness and a Bell inequality for translation invariant states. And the other way around, any translation invariant, any entanglement weakness over inequality for translation invariant states, you can turn it into an entanglement weakness over inequality for finite systems with no symmetry, based on the structure factors. And the cool thing about this Bell entanglement weakness is that they will be maximally violated by ground states and local Hamiltonians, because they're simply local. Okay, so the idea is to try to characterize entanglement and non-locality in this kind of system. So how? I don't know if you've ever applied to an European Research Council grant, But if you do, you will observe that they have, well, they seem to believe that whenever a theoretical physicist embarks on some project, he already knows how he's going to solve the project, more or less. And all you have to do is to, I don't know, write 10 pages about how you're going to solve all the problems that you want to attack in the next 5 years. The first time I saw this, I thought they were drunk or something, because, I mean, of course, it doesn't work like this, right? I mean, if I knew the answers to the problems, I would have the solution. It's a theoretical problem. It's not a practical problem. I don't have to build anything. But then he thought, Miguel, you're so arrogant. These people have been funding people since 2009. It's crazy, right? I mean, so what do you think that you know better than them? And indeed, when I went to my office, then I found that I had a methodology in one of the drawers, right? And this methodology was perfectly detailed how to solve all these problems that I got to show you now. And it was it's really in such a simple way that even a committee of people who are not experts in my area could have understood it. So it's really, really cool. Okay, and everything is based on this tool. The tool is called the solution of the marginal problem for 1D classical translation invariant distributions. Now, maybe the name doesn't won't ring a bell, but most people in quantum metaphysics knows about this property. The problem is this one. Suppose I give you some distribution for n variables. And then I ask you, does there exist some translation invariant distribution, which is infinite, and which has some marginals, exactly the same distribution that I gave you in the first place? This is the problem. Okay, the solution is very simple. Well, if it is translation invariant, if the distribution is translation invariant, then the distribution of these first n minus 1 variables must be equal to these n minus 1 variables. And that condition is also sufficient. You can prove that you have a distribution that satisfies this requirement, and you can extend it to the whole chain.
If the main is marginal, probably, what is a marginal?
It would be the distribution of these n minus 1 variables. This is the marginal distribution of the whole distribution. Okay? Okay, well, we discovered this independently, but then talking to people in quantum matter, many people know about this, right? So we couldn't find a reference, so if you want that proof, it's there. It's a very simple proof in any case. Okay, so now let's start to use this tool to say something about entanglement in translation invariant chains. Okay, so the problem I want to solve is this one, right? I mean, the scientists have access to an n-partite quantum state, and they want to know if there exists a translation invariant and multi-separable state which is compatible with what they are seeing. And in that case, we will see that the state that they have admits a translation invariant and separable extension. Okay, so the first result using this tool, yeah?
Do you have a guarantee that there exists an extension if you drop the separable?
Well, in general, no. I mean, mathematically, not. But I'm assuming that this thing comes from a translation invariant state.
Well, yeah, exactly. The problem so that this comes from some translation invariant state.
Yes, yeah. Well, this is related actually to the marginal problem with quantum mechanics. I'll mention it a bit, but not much, because I don't really have any new results. Okay. So, well, using the property that, well, the solution of the marginal problem for classical systems, you can prove that any state that admits a translation invariant and separable extension admits a decomposition like this. So here you have, the state can be written as some complex combination of pure product states. This is a separability condition. But now the extra condition is that you can choose the distribution to satisfy this other condition. Namely, that the distribution of the first n minus 1 variables is equal to the distribution of the last n minus 1 variables. And this guarantees you that there exists a translation invariant extension of this thing. You can always extend the distribution, and therefore you can always extend the states. Okay, this is very useful. You want to build examples of states which are separable and translation invariant. But it's not that not useful to detect entanglement, because if I give you a state, it is very difficult to prove that it does not admit this decomposition. So at the beginning, we're concerned maybe there was a simple characterization of this kind of states. And then in order to find this characterization, the simpler characterization, we thought about the classical case. In the classical case, you know that this admits a translation invariant extension if the distribution of these variables is equal to the distribution of these variables. So the analog in the quantum case does not work. The analog would be the following. If you have some state, which is the marginal or the Dirichlet's D matrix of a translation invariant state, then you can show that it's very easy, right, that the Dirichlet's D matrix of n minus 1 systems, well, that doesn't really depend on where you are, right? I mean, it should be equal to this other reducibility matrix. However, the inverse does not hold true. Because, I mean, I can give you, for example, a singlet. a singlet has this property, right? In the sense that the redundancy matrix of one system is equal to the other, but it's obviously not extendable because it's a pure state. But we're dealing in this case with separable states, and separable states are nearly classical. So we were thinking that perhaps this should be enough. Namely, to demand that the state is separable, and also that it satisfies this marginality condition. But it is not. So what we did in the paper is to identify some separable two-qubit state. It has the property that rho 1 is equal to rho 2, but this state does not admit any translation invariant extension, separable or entangled. So it's a really, really bad criterion. You have to think a bit more. But okay, it gives you some other idea. Suppose that, okay, I demand that this state, it is separable, it satisfies this marginal property, and also it admits a translation invariant extension, which makes, by the way, this condition superfluous because it follows from this other one. So would this be enough? And it is not enough. And that's also cool because it shows that this problem is actually rich. And I will show you why. What we did is to identify some family of infinite translation invariant quantum states. They are qubits. And they have the property that the redundancy matrix of nearest neighbors is separable. But there doesn't exist any translation invariant separable state which is compatible with this. Or it doesn't meet any translation invariant separable extension. And the way we prove it is like this. Well, you identify this state using the Jordan-Vigenère transformation and doing some tricks. And these states have the property that the average value of sigma x tensor sigma y is 1/2 plus a bit more. And at the same time, we have proven that any state which emits a translation invariant and separable extension satisfies this inequality. So this state is separable because it's PPT, it satisfies the positive, it's positive under partial transposition, but at the same time it's violating this thing. So we know that it does not admit a separable extension. It admits many extensions, meaning translation invariant extension, but not a separable one. Well, just as an aside, this is not the only entanglement witness that we found. We found really lots of them, right? I mean, but I'm not going into detail. Okay, so what does this mean? What does this family mean? It means that two people who are observing these sites, they would know, okay, this state is separable, but it's telling us at the same time that the whole chain is not separable. And what this means is that if we have more parties and we could block, consider bigger blocks, then at some point we would have an entangled state. For some n, if you take n consecutive sites, you will be holding an entangled state. And an obvious question is, well, how large should n be? Well, we solve this question in general. And how large n should be just depends on this violation. So suppose that you have some inequality that is to be respected by all states with a meter translation invariant extension, a separable extension. And suppose that you have a translation invariant state that violates it by some amount delta. Then you can show that if you take a number of sites which is inversely proportional to delta, then if you take the state of n consecutive sites, then this state is guaranteed to be entangled. And this holds not only for bipartite witnesses, but any multipartite witness. It's a general property, which I think is cool, because normally in entanglement theory, you don't really know what to do with the degree of violation of an entanglement witness. So you have an entanglement witness, okay, you have this inequality, I'm violating, I have an entangled state. Okay, but what is the difference between violating by 10 to the minus 5 and 2, right? Well, in this case, you have a clear intuition. The inverse is telling you how many systems you need to hold in order to have an entangled state. Okay, now I'm going to speak about non-locality. I remind you, in case you forgot, a black box is simply a device that takes an input that gives you an output. And then a classical black box is the same, but the output is kind of predetermined. It's just that you don't know it. So there's some probability distribution. Okay, a translation invariant black box would be a box such that the box of n consecutive sites does not really depend on where in the chain we are. And a classical translation invariant black box would be a box that you can simulate classically. It would be a box such that the output of its box is already predetermined and is distributed with some probability distribution for the whole chain, which is translation invariant. Okay, now the problem is the same, right? The scientists have access only to a finite part of the infinite cake. And they want to know if the whole cake is actually classical or not. Well, in this case, we were more successful. We can characterize exactly the set of all boxes which emit a translation invariant and classical extension. And this is, well, soon we'll make the connection with condensed matter. Okay. Okay, so suppose that this box admits a translation invariant and local extension. Then By definition, it should arise from some local hidden variable model, which emits by itself a translation invariant extension. But because of the solution of the marginal problem, we know that this condition is just equivalent to this one. So what this means is that if you want to know if this distribution emits this extension, all you have to do is to find some set of numbers or probabilities, right? They are positive, they add up to one, they satisfy these linear restrictions, and then you're done. Well, this is a problem you can solve using linear programming. Now, is there people here who do not know about linear programming? You don't know? No? Okay. Well, linear programming is a part of numerical analysis which is concerned with this kind of problems. I give you some vectors, and the problem is to minimize the overlap of this vector with the variables of the problem, under the assumption that this other vector has all the entries non-negative. Linear programming was developed in World War II in order to solve allocation problems and logistics. It turns out that after the war, many people found application for these linear programs in enterprises, because a big company also has the same logistic problems as, say, the US Army or the Russian Army. And that's why the inventor of linear programming was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics in 1975. This other guy, he discovered independently linear programming and also gave us the simplex method, which is one of the most famous methods to solve these kind of problems. It is so famous that a few years ago, a new scientist gave it a cover, the algorithm that runs the world. And it's not really an exaggeration, because it was estimated that every minute tens of hundreds of thousands of calls to the simplex method are made. It's a really, really important algorithm for logistics. Well, the take-home message is, if you have one of these problems, one of these linear problems, then you're safe, because they are really, really good algorithms to solve it. And why is this a linear program? Well, we don't have anything to minimize, so you can just minimize zero. And the variables of the problem would be the x's, if you want, would be these probabilities, because this is the input, these are the probabilities, okay? These will be the variables. Now, they have to be be positive, this we can account with these inequalities here. They have to satisfy some linear constraints, we can also account for them with these inequalities. So therefore, this is a linear program. And the first time I saw these kind of things, I was a bit surprised that people spend their time minimizing zero. What does that mean, right? I mean, the solution must be zero, right? But it's not, right? I mean, if the solution is zero, provided that there is a solution. But sometimes there is not a solution. And in that case, what happens is that the solver will tell you that there is not a solution, and he will hand you a sort of computer-generated proof. So whenever this thing emits a translation invariant local extension, then the solver or the computer will find the hidden variable model. It gives you a proof. And when it doesn't, it will give you a proof that it cannot have. So it's a win-win. Also, you can use these ideas to minimize linear functionals on the probabilities of any box that emits one of these extensions, right? Obviously, right? Because it's also a linear program. Okay, for me, the most important thing is geometrical. I mean, the most important lesson. Suppose that you represent each of these boxes as a point in a probability space. So each of these lines represent the value of some probability of this box, right? And each box is just a point. Then you can consider the set of all points that can be simulated with a classical device. And what we have just shown is that these points, because they can be characterized through linear programming, they form a polytope. And a polytope is a convex set defined by a finite number of linear inequalities. Now, using the standard combinatorial software, you can find these inequalities, which is what we did. And these inequalities, in quantum foundation, we call them Bell inequalities. Okay, so these are two that I found. There are inequalities for a scenario in which you have three parties, but the three parties don't have access to the whole distribution. Maybe only have access to this distribution, these other two boxes. And the reason is that I wanted something that you can use estimate through structure factors. Okay, so these are some variables that depend linearly on these probabilities, right? Actually, this is the expected value of an observable related to each of the sides that can only take plus and minus values. And this is the expected value of the product of these two observables. And then you get these two inequalities, right? Now, the problem is whether you can violate these inequalities with translation invariant quantum systems. This is the problem I wanted to solve. Okay. So how do you do this? Well, you could imagine that you could hand each of the parties, for example, a quantum system of dimension 4. And then, these are mean values. You have to replace them somehow by operators, right? So you could say dichotomic operators with the spectrum plus and minus one, and a nice family is given by these two. Once you do that, then what you have is a Hamiltonian. It's a Hamiltonian for three particles, a free local two-body operator. And the idea is to compute the minimum value of this operator over ultra-linear invariant quantum states. And I will give you some point or some distribution or some box that you can achieve with quantum mechanics. But this problem is equivalent to finding the ground state energy per site of this three local two-body ultra-linear invariant Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian that you get when you take that term and then you translate it over the chain. And this is where quantum matter physics enters, right? Because this is a problem that you can solve using IMPSS. We're very excited when we read this part, because we thought, oh my God, we're going to compute a ground state. We're going to be real physicists. We're going to be real men. Fantastic, fantastic. And then also we're very, very enthusiastic because we knew what Metis product states were, but we had never optimized with them. But we have heard in so many talks, so many people saying like, yeah, there's so many open source programs for IMPSS. It's so easy to do these optimizations. So whenever we back on the project, we thought that we were going to find a wonderful world of software for IMPSS optimization. We're really, 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 really excited, right? But no. No. There are. I'm going to make a critical review about what we found, and because it was the horror, really. Eh? Okay. To begin with, most solvers do not allow you to optimize over IMPSS. They only consider finite chains. Now, of those that do, many of them only allow you to optimize a class of two local Hamiltonians per qubits. In order to operate, all this software requires you to install lots of packages. And the last package does not install. Now, I understand, because I also code things, right? I mean, many coders do not care about Windows users, but I think the people who code this, they just hate them, really. I mean, because it's always the last package. It's never the second or the first. Huh? And then the last thing is just something about, pure logic, right? What is the minimum specification that you would ask for a program to compute that computes the ground state energies? Well, you input the Hamiltonian, this is like MATLAB notation. You input the Hamiltonian, the local dimension, and then you want to know what is not only the ground state energy per site, but you also want to know what are the tensors of the state that achieve this thing. Okay, it's a minimization problem. You want to know the solution, also the minimizer. We couldn't find anything like this. At least 1 year ago. A year ago, we couldn't find anything like this. So we had to use, creativity or whatever. So we use this open source MPS program that is really, really fast and really, really, precise, except sometimes it's not precise and sometimes they give you unphysical values, which was what we were worried about. And when we use this thing to optimize or to explore this region, right? And whenever we found a good candidate, then we used TEBD, which is really, really slow. That's why we try to use it as few times as possible, right? And that's how we managed to get violations, okay? So these two inequalities, you can violate it with translational invariant quantum systems. Now, these two inequalities, the reason why I put these two is because they have completely different meanings. So this one, take this one. Forget about translational invariants. I give you some box that has the property that the distribution of these two boxes is equal to the distribution of these two boxes. And then you try to minimize this thing over the local boxes with this restriction. And what you find is that the minimum is actually -4. So what does this mean? This means that when you consider the translation invariant box that minimizes this thing, right? I mean, what happens is that this tripartite box is non-local. So in order to detect non-locality in this scenario, you don't need to consider translation invariants. You don't really learn anything about translation invariant. All you have to do is to measure these three sites and then check whether this is a classical explanation. Okay, so this really indeed is not telling us anything about translation invariants. Now this is different. In this time, what we did was to take the box that you get using DMRG or TBD, and then we added some translation invariant local noise. So we obtain another box, it's still translation invariant, it's still realizable in a quantum system, but it has the property that this tripartite box is local. It can be simulated with a classical device. It can be simulated with a classical device, but it still violates the inequality. So what this means is that while this box can be simulated, people conducting measurements in this box will know that the whole chain cannot be simulated. So this is the kind of inequalities that I was looking for, right? I mean, these are inequalities that are really detecting genuine translation invariant locality.
What about adding the noise?
Because if I don't add the noise, what happened was that this tripartite box was also non-local.
Okay.
That's a good question. Well, we found many of other inequalities. Some of them allow you to do detect genuine transition environmental localities, some not. Now, this part is a bit more esoteric. We wanted to extend all these things to more than, one day I realized that I can also jump and also I can also go like in front, right? So I had, there are more dimensions that I didn't explore. I wanted to extend all these things to two dimensions or three dimensions even. But then we found a problem. In the 1D case, we could use this tool that we know the solution of the marginal problem. But in the 2D case, we couldn't find anything. We talked to many quantum matter physicists. They couldn't really tell us anything about this problem. The problem is the same. I give you some distribution for some variables, and then I ask you whether there exists a relation invariant system in dimension 2 that has this marginal. And, well, okay, in the end, we found, right after we put the results in archive, that we found that actually some people have studied the problem, not that many people, but it's really difficult to find it. Eh? I mean, you cannot just Google it. Eh? You won't find it. Okay, from a foundational point of view, this is an interesting problem. It's not quantum, but it's just nonetheless interesting. And the problem is, suppose I give you, well, some scientists are exploring an infinite translation invariant system. What would they see? This is classical, right? I mean, they can see with the neckties, right? So it's an interesting question from the foundational point of view. How the condition of translation invariant limits the statistics of these people? Well, there are good values. The good news. The good news is that sometimes you can solve this problem. So for example, suppose, well, this is a special case, right? But suppose that you're not only interested in knowing whether there exists a translation invariant extension, but also one that is also, it has also a reflection symmetry. That is invariant the reflection on both axes. Then this problem, you can solve it. It's very stupid, actually. All you need to do is to verify that this product distribution is invariant under this reflection and this other reflection. And that's enough to guarantee that you can extend it to the whole plane. There's another situation that where you can solve things. Suppose that you have bits that each of these random variables can only take two values. And I give you distributions of nearest neighbors. Then we found that you can also solve this problem. And it's trivial, actually. The solution is simply that, well, if this is translation invariant, then the distribution of this site should be equal to the distribution of this other site, which should be equal to the distribution of this site and this other site. And it turns out that is sufficient too. I guess people, well, if you work with spin systems, right? I mean, it's kind of stupid, right, to work in these problems because it's trivial. And the same happens in three dimensions. This is also curious. Okay, for treats. For treats, this does not happen. For treats, it's not enough to check that this distribution is equal to the distribution or something like that. But for treats, what happens is that these distributions are living inside a polytope, or say the set of translation invariant marginals is also a polytope, and we know the vertices. There are 98 vertices. So you can use linear programming to tell, if I give you some distribution, you can use linear programming to tell me whether you can reproduce it or not. And also with bits, not with nearest neighbors, but nearest and next to nearest neighbors. Suppose I give you this problem. This problem is not trivial, again. But again, the set of distributions that you get is living also inside a polytope, and we know the vertices. It's 13 vertices. Now, in this case, normally I don't like to speak about proofs, but in this case, it's kind of easy, right? I mean, the idea, so I can give you the intuition of how we get the result. Okay, so if these things emerge out of a translation invariant system, what will happen is that there should exist some 4x4 set of variables, right? Or 2x2 set of variables, with the property that this distribution is equal to this distribution, and this one to this one, et cetera, right? And also, it satisfies some symmetries, because the distribution of these two things should be equal to the distribution of these two things, and the distribution of these two should be equal to these two. Okay, this is what I'm putting here. Okay, of course, in principle, not all distributions, not all translation invariant, not all distributions satisfying this will be translation invariant. But this is a relaxation of the property of being translation invariant, and it's a polytope too. It's a polytope relaxation. Okay, because it's a polytope, then we could use this software for combinatorial optimization to identify the extreme points. And the extreme points are 13, and we verify that each of them emits a translation invariant extension. So what this means is that any convex combination of them will also emit a translation invariant extension. What it means is that this darker blue zone does not exist. It's really a characterization of the set of translation invariant marginals. A bonus is that if you give me any translation invariant Hamiltonian for bits or treats, then I can compute the minimum energy per site analytically. Because by convexity, the only thing you can do, you need to do is to compute the values for all possible extreme points and then compute the minimum of all of them. And there are only 13. Okay, so this is more or less the state of the art about the exact solutions of the of this problem. Now, if you don't, if you're not in this one of these scenarios or bits or treats, then you can use. I can give you an algorithm. The algorithm is very rudimentary, right? I mean, if this admits a translation invariant distribution, there should exist some distribution for a rectangle of 2 times n that has this local translation invariant, that this thing is equal to this thing, and this distribution is equal to this distribution, and this is a marginal of it, right? This is a relaxation of the property of being translation invariant, but the error that you're making is 1 over n, so the order of 1 over n. And I suspect this is really the optimal thing you can do, but I'm not sure. The bad news. The bad news are very discouraging. Okay, let's recap about what we know about the solved cases. In one dimension, you can solve it, everything lives in a polytope, and you can compute exactly ground state energies. In two dimensions, plus reflection symmetry, everything lives in a polytope, you can compute ground state energies, exactly. The same when with 2D nearest neighbors in dimensions 2 and 3. Okay, so the properties are, in all the unsolved cases, you can compute the ground state energies exactly, and they are rational convex polytopes. Now, you remind that if you go to higher and higher local dimensions, maybe, well, these properties, at least one of these properties will still hold. No. No, it's not difficult to prove that, well, let's think about computational ground state energies per site. It's not difficult to prove that there doesn't exist any algorithm to solve this problem. The problem is I give you some Hamiltonian for nearest neighbors. All these terms can only take value 0, 1, and then you have to compute what is the minimum energy per site. And this problem is undecidable because it's very easy to see that you can code you can encode tiling problems into this thing. So it's curious because it's a problem that I can get the solution up to arbitrary precision, but I cannot give you the exact solution. Okay, so by duality, what this means, by the way, is that at some point we won't be able to characterize this set completely. For some value of d, it doesn't matter how many knowledge of combinatorial optimization you use, you won't be able to characterize this. Okay, we may not be able to characterize it, but I'm still interested in what are the properties of this thing. I mean, I'm still interested in particular whether it's still a polytope. It could still be a polytope, it's simply that these extreme points are undecidable. It's impossible to calculate them. But no, it's not a polytope. Using a really complicated argument that involves tilings, measure theory, and a bit of number theory, we prove that when the dimension is greater than 2,947, this set has flat and smoothly curved parts. And it's even worse. It's not only not a polytope, it's not a semi-algebraic set. What this means is that you cannot describe it with a finite number of polynomial inequalities. Which is a pity, because I was hoping that perhaps I cannot describe it with linear programming, but I can describe it with semi-definite programming, which is a tool that well allows you to describe some rounded sets. But no, it doesn't really work. OK, so what can I say about this set? It is convex and closed, period. OK, so now what we're doing is, we'll just conclude with this. We're trying to find solve the marginal problem for d equals 4. And pray that it's a polytope. Because if we could, then we could start getting say things about translation invariants, translation invariant, the locality of translation invariant boxes in two dimensions. Because you need a hidden variable model of dimension 4 in order to explain what happens when you have two inputs and two outputs. And I'm going to close here with a picture of people involved, and thanks for your attention.
So in the first part of the talk, when you were saying about the detection of entanglement in the system, you finally ended up finding states, just to make sure that I understand, states in which you need a certain number of parties to detect correlations, otherwise, to detect entanglement, otherwise you find.
No. You detect the entanglement. No, you need many parties to hold the entanglement, but it's enough to two parties to detect the entanglement.
Okay, otherwise, so. I mean, those parties, doesn't matter really how they are disposed, or do they have to be consecutive?
I didn't explore that, yeah. It's a good question. I don't know. I guess we could see it, yeah.
Okay, because does that tell you something about the state, for example? If you want to generate that state, does it tell you something about you only needing to add certain scales, say,
Like
the entire
is on. I see. Well, it is a long, short range, or
Yeah, something really good as well is the scale, which you need to introduce in time to generate the state, for example.
I haven't explored this law. I don't know.
Well, maybe one question. You mentioned neutron scattering at some point.
Yeah.
So, do you think there are applications in that area in terms of like detecting whether the system has a certain amount of entanglement?
Yeah. Actually, there were other papers where people study what happens when you have access to a structure factors, right? Entanglement that I didn't say is so excitable. But all these papers, the witnesses that they propose are not local. So what this means is that in so many cases, these witnesses are not maximally violated by a ground state. You really need to go to really highly excited states, so they're really difficult to violate.
Where
does 2947
come from?
It's from the tilings. I don't think it's a fundamental problem. What we know for sure is that between dimension 4 and dimension 2947, right? Somewhere here, that there's a transition, and then things stop being politos and become something more complicated. But we don't know where. And the reason we got this horrible number is because all the proof relies on tilings, and tilings are not really a good way to encode information. I could believe that you can get this for 8, for dimension 8. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So about the two-D
classical case, you mentioned that you can find the minimal energy, the original defined minimal energy for classical systems.
For a classical system, but when they have bits, or they have only two values or three values, yeah.
It's essentially isolated.
Yeah, yes, yeah.
So, could you generalize this to finite temperature, then we can bound the energy?
Yeah, we have thought about that, and it's curious. What happens is that this only happens when you have dimension 2, right? But when you have nearest neighbor, okay, let me put it like this. Yeah, you have a lattice, and then you have access to nearest neighbors, but also next to nearest neighbors. Okay, this one and this one, right? If you consider the extreme points of this set, what you get is, you get some partial information about these things, and then you try to find whether you can extend it to the infinite lattice. And you find that you can only extend it in one way. There's really no, that part was really easy, because all we have to do is to follow our lead until we found like a regular repetition, and then we found that you could get this point. So what this is telling me is that if you're in one of these points, the entropy is zero. Actually, it's not true. What happens is that these points are generated when you get like some sort of a square with zeros and ones, right? Zero, zero, one, one, whatever. And then you repeat it infinitely many times in the lattice, and then you average with the translation operator. So let me see. So you call this the number of sides here n and m. Then the entropy would be it's n times m, yeah. Say n times, yeah, the entropy is n times m, yeah. So we know the entropy in some cases, and perhaps one could extend it. I don't know.
There are no further questions, and let's thank you again.